Welcome to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Are robots coming for your job, for your home? We're going to talk with two local roboticists about what these machines can do right now, where they're headed, and why these experts love the whole journey. So stay tuned. First, our top story is that wildfire season is here. One of the first big fires of the season is in Kittitas County, home of Ellensburg and Clay Ellum. The entire town of Vantage has been evacuated. I-90 was closed. It's supposed to reopen soon. And joining us live is reporter Anna King with Northwest News Network. Hi, Anna.
Good morning, Bill.
How big is this fire?
This fire is really about 1,000 acres large, and it is burning towards the south. It has been really bad winds this morning. People are telling me they're about 30, 35 miles an hour, which is really driving that fire. And it's in dry grass and sagebrush. And it has also started fires on the other side of the Columbia River, on the east side of the Columbia River. But they've been able to manage to get those out.
How close is the fire to people?
It has evacuated about 120 people so far out of the area of Vantage around that little small burg. And firefighters are trying to save structures there. It's not very far from Kittitas, Ellensburg, you know, massive blueberry farms, orchards, hay farms, cattle. So there's a lot at stake here. There's a Red Cross station in the small town of George nearby that people are able to evacuate to. But so far, there hasn't been a lot of people showing up there.
I think a lot of our listeners will be familiar with Vantage right there on the banks of the Columbia River. Has it been especially dry there this early summer?
It has been. I'm a real avid hiker and I love to be outside. And I've been noticing that we've lost most of our wildflowers now. They're dried out and the hills have gone from a soft velvety green to more of a kind of a burnt rusty color or golden color. And so it really is drying out. In fact, wheat farms have started harvesting. They start about July 5th. And that's always my cue that things are heating up out here.
Anna, you said the fire seems headed south, and this is about 50 miles north-northwest of the Hanford nuclear cleanup site. Is there any danger the fire could spread to Hanford?
You know, I'm always cautious when I link fire to Hanford, but I want to tell listeners that, you know, this is anytime there's fire and anytime it's summer, there's always a risk of fire at Hanford. And so people are very careful and, you know, everybody tries to keep a really fresh eye out to make sure that, everybody's prepared. Officials are saying they're watching this fire closely, but that they're not responding yet.
You've been covering wildfires now, Anna, for more than a decade. What have you seen change over the years around here?
You know, the first big fire I remember covering was in 2012 with the Taylor Bridge fire. And when I was on that fire, I was like, man, this is a different type of fire than I've seen. And since then, I've covered the Carlton Complex and the aftermath of that fire. I've covered the fires in Wenatchee and Chelan while they were going on. I remember huge pieces of ash the size of a silver dollar or a quarter falling upon my shoulders when I was downtown Chelan. And, you know, I've learned a lot in the time that I've reported on these. When I went to the fires near Chelan, it was always in my mind before that, like, oh, a fire couldn't jump the Columbia River. That's just too far for it to run across. And then when I saw that happen in Chelan and Wenatchee areas, I was like, oh my gosh, that was a paradigm shift for me. And then seeing huge Apple warehouses, like it would be like if a Costco burnt down and just the walls were listing like Grecian temples. That's kind of the scene that I saw up there. And it just changed the paradigm for me. It's like fire can go anywhere and it can really destroy anything, just concrete and parking lots. It can totally rip them apart. And I saw apples baked on the tree up there. It really changed my mind.
And Anna, are you speaking as a reporter now, or does this feel personal to you as well?
Well, living in Eastern Washington, fire is very personal to me. In fact, this spring I had a neighborhood block party for my neighbors, and we all gathered in my backyard and we talked about how to make our houses more fire ready for the season. And many of my neighbors took action after that, cleaning their gutters or doing different things to try and make their homes more fire ready. It's on a very personal level for me now.
And of course, I'm talking to you far away in Seattle. I'm wondering, though, how much higher the risk has gotten for urban wildfires.
Yeah, I was on a major expedition earlier this spring in Montana to learn more about fire. And what they taught us out there is just that cities are kind of like these mini forests. They're actually a forest, just kind of placed in the middle of bigger forests, especially Seattle and cities like Seattle and Portland. You have trees running, you know, all the way from downtown all the way up to Clee Elm. And fires really don't care if you call it Seattle or if you call it Kittitas County. They're going to burn right through. So really what cities need to do and to think about is creating large buffer zones between, you know, areas so that there are these containment zones where firefighters can get ahead of a fire and be protected to fight the fire. When there's just contiguous trees, people just can't get in between that and fight the fire effectively. So many cities are creating these large swaths between themselves and outlying forests. This is happening in Canada, happening in other cities like Chelan and Wenatchee, where they're creating more fire-wise cities. And you know, in your own home, you're able to do things for yourself to keep yourself and your neighborhood and your house safe as well.
I want to ask you about what people can do personally, but I'm just picturing you're describing protective buffer zones, large swaths, but you're talking about what a choice. You're talking about areas with no trees, right?
Yeah, and that is hard for, I think, Northwest people to get their heads around, because one of the major lovely things about living in the Northwest is this beautiful green or beautiful sagebrush around your community. And so I think that it's a new paradigm of do we protect the city and create maybe a walking path or an impervious area or a low fire area that we can protect? Or do we risk a big fire coming to town?
Right. And what were you saying then, Anna, about things people can do to prepare for a wildfire?
Yeah, you know, when I was in Montana, I learned about all these skills that it's called FireWise. And if you Google that, you can look up a lot more information about it. But basically, it's that the sparks ahead of a fire are actually the prime thing that will start your house on fire, not the fire itself, mm-hmm. and that it can happen very rapidly. So you need to clean out your gutters, get wood piles away from your home, take your soft furniture inside so it doesn't start a flame on your patio furniture, get barbecues and briquettes and lighter fuels away from your house, and also take down trees that are like pines or other highly flammable trees. And, you know, a lot of conifers are okay, but a lot of those other types of trees could really impact your home. And it's just a different way of thinking about how to protect your home in fire.
Final question, Anna King. Since the 4th of July, there have been dozens of fire starts in Washington, 35 or 40 of them, but the state's been able to stop them from spreading. Can you tell what this wildfire season is likely to be like here?
Yeah, a lot of the United States is in drought right now. From southern Washington to Texas, we're seeing yellow and red and brown splotched maps showing this drought. That means things are drying out. And the wheat, like I said, is golden, and the grasses are golden here in eastern Washington. It's beautiful, but it's also time that things are heating up, and my job's going to get busy.
Yes, well, we'll let you get busy. Anna King, reporter for the Northwest News Network, based in Richland, Washington. She's been telling you about the fire that evacuated Vantage, 1,000 acres or so, and 0% contained. And we talked about the winds they've seen, 35 miles per hour or so. So, Anna, I'll let you go on your way. You're going to this fire, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, thanks, Anna. And stay tuned to KUOW for more of Anna's coverage and our coverage of the fire and wildfire season. Thanks for tuning in to KUOW. We'll continue with the record in just a moment. It's the record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Seattle's ban on single-use plastic straws might have nudged a little hometown coffee chain called Starbucks to announce they will phase out straws globally. In place of the straw is a lid design for Starbucks that looks like a sippy cup. The lid's designer, Emily Alexander, said in a statement that, quote, "It was this very small thing, and now it is so much bigger and more impactful." But it's not a small thing for some Starbucks customers. Robin Powell is an attorney, a writer, a scholar whose work focuses on disability law and policy, and she joins me now to explain why it's not a small thing. Robin, welcome to KUOW.
Thank you for having me.
Starbucks says this lid is an important step forward for the environment. What are potential downsides?
Well, I think one of the biggest things is the disability community wasn't involved in any of this, and if they were, we would have told you that the lids do not help the problem. I cannot pick up a cup, so whether there's a lid or not, that's not going to negate the issue of me being able to drink independently, and that's why the straws are so important.
And what is lost, then? Tell us more about how important straws are and what is lost to people with disabilities.
Well, I mean, you need to drink in order to live. That's a pretty natural requirement. And without a straw, so many of us, including myself, are not able to independently drink. I have a disability and I cannot actually pick up a cup. It's completely impossible. So if I am not given a straw, I am unable to drink at all.
Well, in Seattle, the ban is on single-use, non-reusable plastic straws. So I interviewed someone who told me about bamboo straws and glass straws and metal straws. Those seem like viable options?
So there are a number of options out there. Unfortunately, they don't necessarily work for all in the disability community. So, for instance, many of those straws do not work in hot beverages, and many of us use straws for soup and things like that. Also, metal straws are really awful, or glass ones also. For people who have Parkinson's and other spasms, you're going to break a tooth if you have a spasm while you're drinking. So those are just not viable options. And paper straws also just disintegrate over time. So although there are options out there, unfortunately at this point they don't seem to satisfy the needs of all people with disabilities. And I think that's where including people with disabilities would be really important. If straw companies could reach out to the disability community and work on manufacturing straws that would work, I think we could see some progress.
What kind of a straw would work?
I'm not entirely sure, and that is why I'm not a manufacturer,
uh-huh.
But I think that it needs to have a lot of the same things that plastic straws offer. So, of course, being able to be bended, strong enough that it will withstand heat in different temperatures, but also not too strong that someone has a spasm or something like that and they break their tooth. So it will need to be some material very similar to plastic, and I just don't think at this point we are there, but I know that there is a really big push because obviously we are not against the environment. We strongly believe, we the disability community, that we need to make many changes to save our planet. Unfortunately, I just don't think at this point the needs of people with disabilities have been considered at all.
Have you had increasing trouble, Robin, in getting a plastic straw to use? We've been hearing, these bans I've been hearing about cropping up here and there.
I have not, actually, to this moment. We still have straws in my city and state town, so I have not had any personal issues. I've heard of some. My biggest concern, though, is if we do implement these bans, what happens? And then I would suggest some sort of on-demand option instead so that straws are readily available for those who need them upon request. The only caveat I would add is that they need to actually be available, and people with disabilities and anyone who needs one needs to be able to ask without ridicule. And I think that's something that we do worry about. Is it going to be consistent across chains? And do we meet an employee that really ridicules us or says, you don't really need a straw? I think that would be inappropriate.
Have you seen companies do that well, have a product or a service on demand in a sensitive way?
Yeah, so I actually went on a cruise in April, To Bermuda, and I had no problems on the cruise ship, so they do not provide straws, but they do provide them if you request them. So they're not just automatically given with drinks. And I worried on the first day when I learned this that, oh my goodness, I'm never going to be able to get a straw without feeling awful about myself or people questioning whether I really need them. And I was very surprised, pleasantly, to find out that that was not the case. And then when I got to Bermuda, that is also how they handle straws. And again, I was not, I did not encounter any issues, actually. So I think if done correctly, it could work. I just think we need to make sure that we're doing that.
And what about, Robin, what about carry your own straw? Is that a solution?
That does not seem like a solution to me. We wouldn't ask someone to carry their own silverware. Is that going to be the next thing? Are we going to ask people to carry their own plates? I mean, it just is a slippery slope. And also, these reusable straws and the compostable ones and others, they're just more expensive. And people with disabilities tend to live in more low-income brackets, and it's just not feasible at this point. It's also just putting a burden on people with disabilities that's unnecessary. We don't do that for the non-disabled population.
Again, I'm talking with Robin Powell, attorney, writer, and scholar. She focuses her work on disability law and policy. And you had an interesting story that I didn't know, Robin, about how the plastic straw came to be, these single-use plastic straws came to be in the first place.
Yeah, so straws were invented back in the early 1900s in a hospital, actually, because of people with disabilities and others who were sick and unable to drink beverages independently. And so they were always intended for people with disabilities and others that were unable to drink independently. And so that's what their intention was, and it seems that we're doing a disservice if we're going to try to take that away without a viable option.
Do you think an upside of the ban on single-use plastic straws like Seattle's, is there an environmental upside that you recognize?
I mean, obviously, I believe that we should be reducing the use of plastic, but research has shown that these plastic straw bans don't actually change much. And in fact, other efforts such as eliminating plastic bags are far more effective in lowering plastic use. And so I would encourage localities to really look at that instead.
You know, Robin, finally, I've seen a lot of people on Twitter frustrated with a kind of debate where it seems people with disabilities are pitted against environmentalism. What's your take on that?
Yeah, so we have a really weird history of just always pitting environmentalism against social justice issues. And I don't necessarily think that the two are mutually exclusive. I think that we can promote the rights of people with disabilities while also working to protect the environment. I think we need to do that in a more coherent way, and we need to do it in a more inclusive way so that we're ensuring that people aren't losing their rights or their needs aren't being met while also ensuring that we're saving the planet for generations to come.
Well, Robin, I'm speaking with you right now in the home, the global home of Starbucks, which, as we said, is phasing out these straws globally. What do you want to say to Starbucks right now?
I would encourage Starbucks to reconsider their policy and to engage with the disability community so that we can come up with a more equitable approach that reduces the use of plastic while also ensuring that the needs of people with disabilities are met.
Robin Powell, lawyer, researcher, writer, focusing on disability law and policy. Robin, I appreciate you joining us. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. We're going to talk about Herb, the dishwasher loading robot, and robots in space. Where robots are headed? Are they taking all our jobs? And what are the upsides? All that's coming up. Stay tuned.
Warning! Warning!
It's The Record on KUOW. Amazon is opening another automated grocery store. No human cashiers. There's one in Belltown. The second one is coming to downtown. In the fall, robots already help build cars and Boeing planes and many things, and Amazon's reportedly working on a robot for your home, codenamed Vesta. What is next for robots? Are any human jobs safe? Should they be safe? My next guest builds robots, University of Washington professor Sid Srinivasa from the Allen School of Computer Science and Engineering. Welcome, Sid.
Thank you for having me.
You developed a robot named Herb that can load a dishwasher and sometimes twist open an Oreo cookie.
That's right, yes. Twisting open an Oreo is one of the hardest problems left in robotics, clearly.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about that. Herb is short for Home Exploring Robot Butler, but Herb sounds like a male name. Do you think of Herb as a him?
That's a great question. I think humans naturally tend to anthropomorphize technology. You know, you look at anything and you think of it as a person. We gave Herb first a male voice, and he's sort of big and beefy, and so we do tend to think of him as a male. We also have another robot, Ada. It's an homage to Ada Lovelace, which is an assistive care robot. So we have Herb and Ada in our labs, and they're sort of like my children. I've had them since 2006.
Who is Ada Lovelace?
Ada Lovelace is a world-famous computer scientist. She was one of the first computer programmers.
Mm-hmm. And why an Oreo?
That's a great question. Oreo called me and asked me if I would be interested in doing this. They wanted to shoot a commercial. And actually, and I said, yes, of course, why not, since, we have a robot. And it turns out that the Oreo was the most delicate, most sensitive object that we had ever manipulated. And one of the interesting things here is that before we started it, we had no idea whether Herb would actually be able to separate the cookie from the cream, which is what they wanted. But really, I think the entire exercise was a testament to the building blocks of autonomy that we were building, of machine learning, of motion planning, of control, of AI, that we were able to take this task that clearly Herb was not created for. If you wanted me to build an Oreo separating machine, I can build it for you for way cheaper than Herb.
Okay.
And we were able to do it. So that was really remarkable.
In general, why is the home? You talk about Oreo cookies and Herb can load a dishwasher with some success. Why is the home a particularly difficult frontier for a robot?
The home is built for humans. If you think about robots, they work really well at factory floors that are built for robots, whereas our homes are built for us. They're filled with clutter and uncertainty, and you have no idea where things are. So if we want to get robots out of the factory floors and into people's homes, we can do one of two things. We can either turn our homes into factory floors, which, as much as my wife would like, I just can't do it. Or we can enable robots to work in the clutter and mess that we're able to effortlessly work towards.
I'm talking with Sid Srinivasa at University of Washington, the Allen School of Computer Science and Engineering, and we've got more to say about robots in the home. Also with us, though, is Howard Chizik, who's co-director of the UW Biorobotics Laboratory. Welcome, Howard.
Hello.
You specialize in robots that go underwater and into space. First of all, what did you think of what you heard from Sid on the home front?
He's working on a very hard set of problems.
This says the guy working on underwater and space robots.
So the robots I'm working with are working with humans. We call them telerobots. So you could think of them as extensions of the human hand. So if you want to work somewhere that's very high temperature, radioactive, biohazardous, very cold, very, very tiny, very, very big, underwater, in space, the human hand can't get there. It's not safe. So we work with robots that are in that remote location, acting on whatever the task is that needs to be done, but in coordination with a human operator. So the key issues then are sensing what's happening, because our eyes aren't there and our ears aren't there, giving touch information, force, haptic information back to the operator so they can feel what they're doing, giving them visual information, maybe views from different directions, and then guiding them. So our technology involves recognizing what's going on in the space using some machine learning techniques, and then gently pushing the operator's hand so they do it correctly. And I'll give you an example. If you've ever tried to plug a plug, an electric outlet, you need two hands and you really need to see the plug so that you can line everything up, and you need to push hard enough. That's an interesting problem. Now try and do that underwater, communication cable.
Try twisting an Oreo open in space. Yeah.
So
not easy.
So right now people do this sitting in the bottom of a ship using a little sort of gamepad joystick type thing just with video. And what we've done is at my lab, and then in our spin-off company in town, Blue Haptics, which is in Fremont, we actually have built a system which is now being deployed to do underwater operations. And if you could do it underwater, why not do it in space?
Are you two looking at completely different? Do you have different orientations toward humanity? Because you know, Sid, you're focusing on robot in the home, and Howard, you're talking about robots and in these impossible, out of the way, freezing, etc. places. So I wonder how you think about the human being, the same or differently.
From my end, I want to build robots for care. I want to build robots that can actually help people who are in need of assistance. And if you think about the elderly population in the United States and people with disabilities, if we can build technology that can enable them to live independent lives in their homes for even 6 months to a year longer, then I think that is incredibly powerful. So I think technology can be used as a way to enable people. And I think it's very similar with what Howard is doing, which is we want to get people out of hazardous situations. We want to get technology in there such that it can be an enabler to solve.
What's an example of a hazardous situation you deal with?
So, for example, we work with patients with high spinal cord injuries. So these are with the Rehabilitation Institute of Chicago. For them, everyday living is a challenge, right? So if they want to eat a meal, for example, so we're actually building a robot that can help help a person eat a meal, mm-hmm. like cut chicken or twirl spaghetti. And this is something that takes about 10 minutes for a person with a high spinal cord injury to actually use a robot arm to get to their mouth. If we can get that to, you know, under a minute or a few 30 or 40 seconds, and if we can do it safely, such that the person doesn't choke, the person actually has an independent and pleasurable experience, then it gives them the confidence and dignity of life that they don't have to ask a caregiver to help them to eat.
We were just a few minutes ago talking about the problem of that people with disabilities can have with straws. Can robots help there?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that feeding and drinking are one of the biggest challenges for people with disabilities, especially upper extremity disabilities. Or if you have a high spinal cord injury, then you have very limited mobility of your neck. So if you think about the act of eating breakfast, it's a miraculous act of manipulation. You know, you're doing amazing things with your hands. You're manipulating deformable objects. You're getting it to your mouth. You're doing this beautiful handoff between this goop and your mouth. You're able to chew all of this food.
It is incredible what we do all the time.
And this is something, I mean, if you think about it, this is something that we take for granted all the time.
Yeah.
But really, for people with disabilities, this is every single step of the way is a challenge. And if you can build technologies that can enable them, that can be amazing.
So I'll chime in there. Here's a different approach to helping the same people, and this is going on at the Center for Sensor Motor Neural Engineering, which is based here at UW and also involves MIT and San Diego State. Let's modify the person to give them back the capability to move their arms or to walk. So this involves wireless power and sensors and embedded instrumentation. And this is ongoing research, a very large group here in the city, almost 60 people. It's not exactly a robot. It's sort of a combination of the human who's got broken parts with replacement parts that are added.
I believe bionics was the phrase in my childhood.
Yeah, for bionics, for the prosthetics.
I was the bionic man in my my backyard.
We all were. Yeah. So this is something that's ongoing research in a lot of places, but in particular for grasping tasks, for feeding, for combing, brushing teeth. These are daily care activities that cost a fortune right now to have someone else do and that take away independence from the individual. So, again, these are human-in-the-loop robotics of a sort. Most of the work involves now some kind of neural interface, brain-computer interface, or other connection between the desires of the individual and what the hardware is doing. Is that a robot? Kind of.
Well, you're both talking about helping people with disabilities, people who are elderly, people with illnesses. And I remember when we first started wondering what jobs were going to be safe from robots, a common answer was jobs that nursing, you know, human care. Those are the kinds of things a robot couldn't do. But I'm hearing more and more. I've heard about the care bots in Japan, and you're telling. I'm hearing more that no, robots are going to be better at that too.
you know, there's an active community worried and thinking about this. But if I had to do a guess, I think the biggest threat right now is to people whose living is driving.
Yes, which is
in the majority of American states, that's the number one occupation, because self-driving vehicles will begin to take over some tasks. And there, I think there's a high potential for dislocation.
Yeah.
On the other hand, for things like care, you still need the human contact. You need the human interaction. So I think that—
Do we? Will we? I mean, as robots and artificial intelligence get more human-like, are you sure that—
I think that's a ways away yet.
Uh-huh.
There are people in Japan that are trying very hard to have human interacting robots that seem human, but Japan—
I've seen the video of them picking people up and moving them.
But Japan has got a demographic problem. They don't have enough young people, and they have a lot of old people, so they need those robots. Mm-hmm. So there are relationships between the labor market, and I'll put in a plug for We Robot, which is an annual conference of technology and law and ethics that for the last 4 or 5 years has been addressing this. You can find it on the web.
I was looking at jobs that are doomed or not. There's an organization called Future of Employment, and they reported all these chance of automation of various jobs. And the job that was safest, according to them, 0.3% chance that this job will be automated is mental health and substance abuse social worker. clergy was on the list, but far more likely to get automated, almost three times as much, 0.81%. So safe, but clergy was not a sure thing that clergy are not going to be automated.
Where is the computer science professor on that list? That's what I want to know.
Good question.
I completely agree with Howard, especially about the last point he made about this nexus between technologists, legislators, and law and ethics. I think part of our job as technologists is to make sure that we can work with legislation such that we can understand what the technology is that's going to come about, right? I think one of the challenges that legislation faces is that technology comes out, it's used, then it's misused, and then legislation happens.
Yeah.
And I think part of our job as technologists is to make sure that we are ethical and we actually have open channels of communication with legislation such that we can actually have a little bit more foresight into what the future technologies might be.
Yeah, isn't it your ethics that are going to be driving legislation? The lawmakers don't know what you know.
Well, the lawmakers don't have good future, you know, crystal balls, but maybe we don't either. I'll give you an example. There are surgical robots. Right now, you can have a Da Vinci surgical robot operation. They're very useful because they're less invasive. You only need a few small holes to do a procedure. And right now, the physician lives in the room with the robot. It's not long distance. Now, experimentally, there have been some transatlantic surgeries done. But what state will the doctor have to be licensed in? Mm-hmm. Who's going to be liable? The instrument maker, the robot maker, the programmer, the doctor?
Is there one worst case scenario? Is there some collision you see coming that I want to know about right now?
I think that it's right now it's just not possible to do that legally, okay? Mm-hmm. Except maybe for battlefield surgery where you don't have the same legal restrictions. Self-driving cars. If a car hits a person and it's a self-driving car, who's responsible? Is it the driver that was hit? Is it the person sitting in the car but not driving it? Is it the company that made the self-driving car or the people who made the sensors that the self-driving car used
mm-hmm.
if it didn't see something? Or is it the programmer? This has not been worked out. And complicating is the fact that many of these things go state by state as well as nationally. So finding the legal environment for regulation and protection and finding the goals that you want to have and how to coordinate this is open.
Yeah.
It's an open field, and unfortunately, there are very few people in government that have the technical knowledge to do this.
Sid, Bloomberg reported on this secret Amazon home robot codenamed Vesta. What do you think of what you've read of it?
There's what I've read and there's what I know, so I'll talk about what I've read only.
Okay.
I don't want to
whatever violate, you know.
I violate know. NDAs on air here.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think as you've read on Bloomberg, I think they're excited about the potential of having an Alexa that is actually more mobile than just sitting on your desk.
Yep.
And I think I see great potential for home robotics from such enabling technologies, right? Like things like Alexa, things like your Nest thermometer are creating the petri dish for autonomy. The robot doesn't have to sense everything. The robot doesn't have to know everything. The robot can just talk to the other technology that's out there and know what's happening. And I think that really lowers the...
What's an example how that would work?
So, for example, if you have an intelligent refrigerator, I've been watching too much of Silicon Valley, and that has a camera in it that can actually sense what's inside your refrigerator. Now, the robot doesn't even have to open the refrigerator. It can just query this refrigerator for the image or even what's in there. So I think the more connected your home is, the lower is the requirement for enabling technologies. And I think this has great potential for care. Like, I have a very cautious but very optimistic and rosy view of how robotics and technology can actually enable humans.
A view named Rosie.
That's right.
Some of us are familiar with a robot named Rosie, yeah, from the Jetsons. I saw an ad for a robot called Jibo, which is kind of like the Echo. I try not to call it Alexa because that's its marketing name. It wants you to, you know, it wants me to think of it as a woman or whatever. It's an Amazon Echo, but I think I'm the only one who calls it that anymore. But anyway, the Jibo is about a foot tall and it sits on a man's kitchen counter. It's got a display with a quote unquote face, eyes, mouth, and it shimmies a little while it talks.
Hey, Aaron.
Hey, pal.
Do you want to hear a fun fact?
Sure.
I have your fortune here. Someday soon you will order the extra spicy, but later wish you'd ordered the mild.
Likely.
Meet Jibo. He looks, listens, and learns.
Oh, Jibo, you cheeky little robot. Why do we want our robots to fool us into thinking they're like us? Why do I want... I don't need my toaster to have a personality. Why do I want a thing on the counter that seems to be so jovial?
I think we're pre-programmed. If the robot has eyes and a face and looks at you, looks like a child, or talks to you with sufficient skill that it sounds like a person, we make them human. That's the way we're built.
Well, why do we want that? I hear people say, oh, robots are so creepy and weird. Well, we don't have to make it look like a person.
I don't think we want it. I think that we're built that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's more comfortable in interacting. Now, there is this thing called the uncanny valley, which is why all the cartoons have eyes that don't look realistic, because if you make them realistic, it gets spooky. And if the robot looks too human but not quite, it doesn't quite have the right facial expressions, it twitches a little bit too much, then it's spooky.
Now it's creepy. Yeah.
So you have a choice of either making the robot something that is comfortable, and so make it look like a kitten, look like a little baby, you give it big googly eyes, or else you make the robot not look like a person at all. You give it a shiny head of steel so it doesn't look like a person. Yeah. And that's a trick.
Yeah. People actually often use embodiment as a cheat code. You know, if your robot is embodied, then you're more willing to forgive its mistakes. If a robot talks to you and is cute, then you're like, oh, adorable robot. You're just an iPhone on a stick, but you know, I forgive you for your mistakes.
Sure.
But I think the personal robot market is actually very fascinating. And I think a lot of it has got to do with the cultural zeitgeist, right? If you look at countries like Japan, they grew up with Astro Boy and they have just a very different view of how technology is perceived and accepted, as opposed to the United States, where we grew up with Terminator and the Daleks, I guess. And we have very, very different viewpoints of what a robot or technology can do. And actually understanding and mining these cultural nuances is really important if you want to build robots that can actually stay in your homes.
Are either of you concerned about robots in your home or otherwise collecting data about us that we don't know about or we don't approve of? Does that bother you, Howard?
Yeah, I mean, that's a problem. Right now...
And you build the things, so yeah,
well,
tell us about
that. I'm not building devices that sit in your house and listen to everything.
Yeah.
those are already out there. And how you regulate that, how you give permissions, you know, we've all checked off yes when we get 38 pages of detail.
Mm-hmm.
Probably missed the bit where it talks about giving up your firstborn or whatever.
Right.
There is, again, an issue here that there needs to be a set of standards that industry and government and interest groups have to come up with to how to protect privacy. So if I go back to the refrigerator robot, if I know what you eat, do I tell your doctor?
Uh-huh.
Right? Ah, look, there's pie there or ice cream. I mean, how? Where is the line?
Pack of cigarettes.
Yeah. Where is the line on privacy? And that is something that we really have not yet faced.
Sid, you're designing the home robots. Are you designing robots that will listen, collect my personal data, whether I approve of it or know about it?
I hope not. I hope not. So this is a question that we've faced even with the internet, right? When you're browsing websites, they are mining your mouse movements, and they're mining all the clicks that you have if you allow cookies and are not browsing anonymously. And I think there's some very strict legislation that has already been put in place and continues to be put in place about how much of your mouse movements, how much of where you pause your mouse should the website be allowed to know about, right? Every website you go to has a bunch of ads on the side that seem spookily personalized to you, because probably they are, right? There's actually a lot of research being done at our School of Computer Science by the security group to actually try and understand, like, how much of our own security are we leaking through these actions that we're taking that we consider to be very mundane, but yet could give us a lot of information about who we really are.
We have a minute left. Can I get from each of you on the fly a headline that I'm going to be seeing regarding robots that I haven't seen yet, but it's going to be news?
A headline.
Yeah, write a headline.
Robots save lives in emergency.
Uh-huh.
This thing that's happening in Thailand, which they successfully got the kids out.
Yeah.
That could have been done with teleoperated robots or perhaps autonomous robots, but we don't have them yet.
Interesting. Howard Chizik, co-director of Biorobotics Laboratory, University of Washington, makes robots in tight and difficult and extreme spots. So that's interesting. Sid?
I think a
headline.
Robot enables a person who has never been able to take a bite of chocolate on their own to take a piece of chocolate, unwrap it, and enjoy a delicious bite.
That sounds like a fantastic headline. Sid Srinivasa, Boeing Endowed Professor, Allen School of Computer Science and Engineering, University of Washington, and developer of Herb, the Oreo-twisting, maybe chocolate-unwrapping robot. It's great to talk to both of you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
The Record on KUOW, back in just a moment. Today, President Donald Trump pardoned the two Oregon ranchers whose case sparked the occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. The ranchers, Dwight Hammond and his son Stephen, were convicted in 2012 for setting fires on public land. After they were sentenced to 5 years in prison, eventually protester Ammon Bundy and others took over that federal wildlife refuge in southern Oregon. Here with the fuller story is Leah Satilli, host of the Bundyville podcast, which tells the story of that Malheur occupation. Leah, good to talk with you again.
Hey, thanks for having me.
These two Oregon ranchers that President Trump just pardoned, remind us, why did they set a fire on public land?
So the Hammonds live right outside of Burns, Oregon, and their property actually butts up against the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. Setting wildfires, it's actually called a controlled burn in rancher parlance, but lots of ranchers do that to clear off weeds and things like that. You have to get a permit to do it, and you also want to make sure that it is controlled. In these two cases, the Hammonds lit fires on their land that spread onto public land, and that's where the issue started.
And why did they set that fire? Are you saying it was just a routine fire and a complete accident, or that there was something more going on?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it's spreading and getting out of control. they claimed it was an accident. They didn't intend for it to go that far. However, one of those in court, when they were in court for these fires, one of the fires was thought to be covering an illegal deer hunt. But also there were several other fires that the Hammonds were involved in that aren't talked about when we talk about these two other fires. There's at least six other ones that were either started on the Hammonds' land or that they had something to do with.
And why did the protesters, again, remind us, if you will, why did they take over and occupy the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge?
Well, so that was started by the Bundy family. And if you know anything about the Bundys, you know about their 2014 standoff down in southern Nevada over grazing fees and an impoundment of the Bundys' cattle. So they have some pretty unique ideas about what the federal government can do with public land and how much land they can own. When they got away with basically leading a militia down there in southern Nevada who pointed guns at federal agents and they were able to keep their cows, the Bundy brothers, Ammon and Ryan, went up to Burns, Oregon and took over this refuge. And they did it using the Hammond cause, despite the fact that the Hammonds said that they did not want their help, that they were going to return to jail, they were resentenced to go back to jail, and they were going to comply with those you know, that decree for them to go back. So the Bundys have a whole bunch of ideas, but they did use the Hammonds' story to kind of bring attention to their cause.
Why did President Trump say he pardoned the Hammond brothers, these two ranchers?
So, yeah, and it's actually a father and son. The reason for that was they were saying it was just an overreach. This was a miscarriage of justice as they saw it. So the Hammonds were sentenced initially, but under the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which has to do with damaging federal property, which arson of federal land is damaging federal property, the men would have had to serve a mandatory minimum of 5 years. The judge, when he initially sentenced them, gave them a far less sentence than that. And then on appeal, they were released. And then on appeal, they had to go back to jail. So it's Trump's pardon has to do with that going back to jail. They're saying the men did time, that their crimes were there was a lot of disagreement over what these fires were all about, and they should be let out of jail.
Well, there are a lot of cases with disagreement involved. Why do you think President Trump pardoned them, based on anything else you know?
Sure. I mean, we get into a little bit of this in the Bundyville podcast, but it really seems to fit into a couple of things. I mean, as far as the Bundys are concerned, when they were in court in Oregon for the Malheur Refuge standoff, Ammon Bundy talked a lot about wanting to get ranchers back to ranching and miners back to mining and loggers back to logging. And this is really what we've seen a lot from Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke's rolling back federal lands, federal monuments, and trying to open those lands up for oil and gas extraction. So I think that this really kind of fits in that narrative that that we're seeing the administration say, you know, ranchers' opinions matter. We believe that they are the best stewards of the land. And I think that this pardon really kind of lends credence to that idea.
Is it just an idea? Is it just is it limited to symbolism that ranchers matter? Or do you see the relationship between public lands and the various people who want to use them? Do you actually see it changing here in the West?
Well, I think that it's been changing for a long time. So when we saw the FLTMA pass in the late 70s, that all of a sudden opened up the conversation around public land. So it wasn't just ranchers. It changed the time when ranchers ran the West and really caused ranchers to sit at the same decision-making table with environmentalists and outdoor recreationists and have to share that conversation. I think we're seeing with Trump administration policies that they're kind of trying to go back to the way things were. I mean, it's in a way, deferring to ranchers as the best stewards of the land is almost one of the biggest embodiments, I would say, of Make America Great Again. That there's this idea that the way things were was better, and ranchers managing the West is the way they'd like to see things going. So I think, yeah, it's an idea, but I think it's also part of a greater movement.
And finally, we just have a minute left, Leah. What is the significance in that movement of today's news, of President Trump's pardoning of these Oregon ranchers?
I think you could look at it a few ways, but it's hard not to see that that this is just the latest victory for the movement being led by the Mundys, that when they were acquitted in Oregon, that was victory number one. When their trial in Nevada was thrown out because of government malfeasance, that's number two. And then the Hammonds being pardoned is certainly, I would say, a third and victory, but also showing that, you know, they always said that this was a protest, what they were doing down there at the refuge, not an occupation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, perhaps this lends credence to that idea.
Leah Sottile has been following it as host of the Bundyville podcast, telling the story of the Malheur occupation and telling us about the latest news of the Trump pardon of those two Oregon ranchers whose case eventually would lead there to Malheur. And Leah, thanks a lot for telling us the story.
Yeah. Hey, thanks for having me.
Our show today is produced by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jimabrenpong, Allison Bruzek, and Jason Pagano, social media producer Bree Ripley. I'm Bill Radke. Come see us live. Chris Vance, Joni Balter, Nikita Oliver reviewing the week's news on stage at the McMenamins Anderson School in Bothell coming up this Thursday, July 12th. Doors open, 6 o'clock. The tickets are free, but you want to reserve your seat by going to kuow.org/engage. Hope to see you there.